scary movie. Hi, and welcome to Bloody Good Screen. I'm your host, Mike Goddard. As we said in the last episode, what we are looking to do here on Bloody Good Screen is exactly the same as Bloody Good Reads. So we are going to interview people from the horror genre, be it directors, producers, critics, every single corner of the horror genre, and kind of see where they got into the genre, how they got into horror in general, and we'll take it from there. So today's guest, I'm very, very, very happy she said yes to come on to this podcast. If you listen to the Snakebite Horrorcast, which some of you might do, some of you probably don't, we reviewed a film called The Stylist about a month or so back. And it is currently the best film of the year for me. Me and the boys absolutely loved this film. So when I reached out to the director of the movie, I'm so surprised she said yes to coming on. So I'm very proud to welcome to the podcast, Jill Gavar-Gizian. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. So thank you. Again, a huge, huge thank you, because I'm actually a huge fan of The Stylist. One of the best films of the year for me. What we like to do here is basically force people to pick three movies that they absolutely love, because I'm a bastard like that. So it's a hard thing to make people pick. I do this to authors every single week on the book podcast, so I'm going to do it to the film genre now. So I'm going to start the podcast off like I do every podcast and ask you, how did you get into the horror genre?
Oh, man. It's interesting. I know that when I was really little, I loved anything that was scary. Like, you know, first I kind of discovered the books, the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, you know, that have become so iconic. And I love to play any like games at night outside in the dark. And I was just always really into anything that gave me that kind of thrill of being scared. And so then once I discovered scary movies, I was just like in love, you know, fell head over heels. And that was when I was way too young to be watching them at like 9, 10 years old. And I would go stay with one of my best friends that I grew up with for the weekend, and her parents would not pay very much attention to what we would rent. And so we would be watching, like, you know, at 10 years old is when I started to watch stuff. And I very much remember watching specifically like Dr. Giggles at that age, which is fun, you know, it's a funny, great slasher, but Candyman especially is one I watched back then that's still one of my favorite movies. I just became obsessed with it. And really, I always loved movies, and first fell in love with movies that could make me cry. So then I think there's also a connection to the scary thing. It's like these intense emotions that, you know, that they can evoke out of you. I just fell for the idea that like a story could do that to you. And I love that still.
Because you're around the same age as me, so I think especially when I was growing up in the UK, it was more, you had less kind of eyes on the genre, so you could probably get away with watching more than you can nowadays. Especially your parents back then weren't as kind of clued on as parents now are. I mean, I'm a parent myself. I'm never gonna let my child watch stuff that I used to watch. No way. But my mum always used to let me watch a lot of stuff that I would have thought she had no idea I was watching. But it's always a good way of getting into horror, especially younger.
Yeah, they didn't know any better how bad it really was.
Exactly. Friend and me child's play when they probably didn't think it was actually any bad as it was. So, anyway. So did you always want to be kind of in the film genre, or was it something that you kind of looked into doing later on in life? Or?
Yeah, it's not something that I actually even realized was a possibility or in it at all until honestly till I went to a horror convention in my like late 20s and saw some films there, met the filmmakers that made them, and that's when it like all clicked, I think, in my head that like real people made movies. I don't know, it sounds ridiculous, but before that I think I thought it was just something like completely out of reach that I would never even consider. And it was like, I guess it took me seeing like the people that did it behind a specific movie that I saw. I'm like, oh wow, this is a thing that people make movies. when I was younger, like in middle school, young teens, I made funny, silly stuff for fun with friends on like my dad's giant camcorder on VHS tape. but I didn't. I was always really interested in performance art and theater and all different types of creative stuff. And so I just did little things that I think what finally led to this, like photography and music and hair and fashion. But it didn't dawn on me that it was, so it wasn't like something I was like, I'm going to be a filmmaker from like the beginning of my life. I always loved films and loved being part of that world and creating, but yeah, I think I thought filmmaking was too big of a feat or impossible until I saw a person that did it or met one.
Especially the horror genre, the people directing and kind of writing and producing are so laid back and are so normal. You wouldn't kind of expect it when you kind of first meet them. Because I used to go to Fright Fest a lot. You'd meet a lot of people at Fright Fest, directors and producers and writers. You kind of get a different side of it. So, yeah.
You expect them all to be super weirdos. Plenty of us are. Uh-huh.
Well, yes, it's always nice to be a little bit. But wouldn't be a horror fan if you wasn't. But let's kick straight into it then. So, like I said at the start of the podcast, what we do is get you to pick three movies. So what is your first bloody good screen?
Oh man, which one do we do first? Well, since I already brought it up, naturally, we could do Candyman.
Go for it.
Should we say it? How many times do we say it in the mirror?
It's almost 10 o'clock at night here. I don't know if I want to say it many times.
See if he'll show up and join this podcast real quick.
Hey, if I can get Antonio Todd on this podcast, I'd be more than happy.
Tony, oh my gosh, I don't know where to begin on the film. Like I said, it's one of the first horror movies I remember seeing ever in my life. And I don't think it's just because of that. I think it's one of the best and scariest horror movies ever made. And what I specifically love about it is that I love his story and his background, that he kind of has like a similar to like a backstory, like one of the classic monsters, you know, like all the Universal monsters. He has one of those like tragic stories where you know like how he became a monster, and he was made a monster by other humans, which is a lot like, you know, the monster in Frankenstein, or like a misunderstood creature that's created by us or turned into a monster by humans. And so I really love those kind of stories because his story is sympathetic in that way. Like, you know, he was a victim turned into this monster who's also completely terrifying in his own right as well. So I love that kind of stuff. I love the mix of sad and scary. And to me, he's like, you know, it has all this like romance in it because his story is he was in love with this woman, a white woman, and he was killed by this mob of white people because of racism. And it's a fascinating story that I think that's, you know, why they're remaking it. So it's sadly horrifically still relevant. And I just love his story, his backstory. And it's so gothic and Shakespearean. I'm very into that kind of stuff. And then the visuals behind it go into all that, and the music in that film, you know, like the organs, it's so gothic. Like, it's just everything up my alley. I love that movie. And then like just on surface level, as a straight horror movie without any of that deep, like, what are the themes and stuff, it's scary as hell. Like, Tony Todd saying Helen in the parking garage in the daylight is, like, the scariest thing I've ever seen. Like, you get chills all over your body just hearing him. And then, like you said, I feel like he is such an iconic character. And unlike all the other kind of iconic horror killers that are all masked, he's not. So in one way, I'm like, I feel bad for Tony Todd because I see him and I see Candyman. Like, he is Candyman to me forever now. But, and so the first time I got to meet him at a convention, I was like geeked out. Like, you would have thought I was like a 12-year-old and I'm like 29 years old standing in line like, oh my God, I'm going to meet Candyman. This is the coolest moment of my life. I could go on and on. I've been to so many conventions now that I got to actually take a picture with him with him standing behind me in a mirror. And it's like the coolest picture I maybe have ever seen in my life.
That is that's a good photo opportunity. I love the sound of that. And it's a great take on the Bloody Mary story as well. So it's completely different turn, which it's good. It's a really good film. Wasn't a massive fan of the sequels. What do you think the follow-ups? Because they changed the origin story slightly on that one. So his actual kind of the death that he kind of went through.
I pretty much ignore that exists, even though I've watched
it.
I've been saying this a lot lately, but I don't think any filmmaker of the original horror film, like, I mean, the number one of something that turned into a franchise, or even just a couple sequels, ever, like, that was their intention from the start. That's, like, very rare. Like, in all the classics, like, they were forced to do it, or they know, you know, none of the original filmmakers made the sequel. So it's just an interesting thing to think about. Like, that was never really intended by the original filmmakers. I am excited to see the remake or reimagining or whatever words we use for that now for Candyman.
Candyman, which is also called Candyman. Yeah. That reboot, as everything seems to be the same name nowadays. No, the new one looks interesting. I think I prefer the story and kind of feel of the original. Looking at the two trailers together, you would kind of, if you're a slasher fan, I'm a huge slasher fan. That's why I love Candyman. And I remember first time I heard about the film was my family watching it downstairs. Way too young to kind of watch it. And I remember my sister not looking in the mirror for about 3 weeks. And I'm just kind of sitting on the stairs going, I want to know what's going on. Why is everybody so scared? And it's such a great, great, great film. Not as scary as kind of I thought it was going to be, but, you know, with the amount of kind of drama my sister was doing. But I loved the film. And Tony Todd is such a great actor. Very underrated horror actor as well. He's in so many kind of low-budget stuff. He's in so many movies, but you don't hear so much about him anymore. And that's a waste of waste because he's such a great talent.
I wonder if there's a catch 22 of getting a role that iconic is people don't want to try to see you as someone else. You know what I mean? Like, even though obviously an actor can, that's what they do is they act as many different roles, but that's why we see this, you know, the actors, for instance, someone else that's just put into the same, you know, type every movie you see someone in. It's because all the people casting, we, you know, won't just like force ourselves like, oh, maybe let these people break out of their shell and not keep playing the same characters over and over again. But I've always wondered that if like playing something as iconic as Candyman or like Freddy Krueger makes it really hard to get other roles. It's like this one huge thing. Yeah, I don't know.
You're always going to see Robert Englund as Freddy Krueger, even in his more recent work. You know, it's just picture Freddy. That is a perfect choice to start your choices. I'm a huge, huge fan of the slasher genre, so glad somebody's picked a slasher movie.
Me too.
So when you first started out, so you did a lot of short movies. So is your first one Call Girl that you kind of got out there? Because that was shown at Fright Fest, and that was very, very good.
Yeah, that was my first short. I mean, that's when I jumped into filmmaking. The first thing I made since I was like 14 with my dad's camcorder. I became obsessed right away. Like once we made that, I felt like I found that like the thing that I'm like obsessed with and want to like do all the time. And it was like a realization of filmmaking is a combination of so many art forms, not every single one that exists, but like almost all of them you get to like work with people who work in it. And so I think that's why I became obsessed. But yeah, Call Girl was written by my friend Eric Havens, who was going to direct it, and I was going to help produce it. And I didn't even know really what that meant, but I just wanted to help make it and learn about making a film. And then he realized like directing wasn't really the path he wanted. He's just more focused on writing and doesn't like the stress that comes with the directing part. And so I just asked if I could do it. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And here I am now. still trying to figure it out.
And you've actually got a huge actor in your first short as well, Lawrence R. Harvey from Human Centipede 2 fame. That must have been quite an interesting interesting chat after he's released that movie.
That was a dream scenario. I met Lawrence at one of the horror conventions, that first one where I discovered filmmaking, that was a real thing that could happen. I met him that weekend, and I met the guys who made Dear God No, Frankenstein Created Bikers. James Bickert is the director of those movies. I became friends with them that weekend, and they maybe already knew Lawrence, I think is the situation. I met Lawrence because I wanted to as a fan, but then I also got to hang out with him a lot behind the scenes because of them. And we stayed in touch thanks to social media. And I shared the script Call Girl with him really just for his thoughts on it. And he wrote me back saying he wanted to be in it. And I was like, oh my God, oh shit. Like I was actually very intimidated and scared. I wanted to do it, but I thought I was too scared. Like I would be too intimidated to do it. And then I finally came around to realizing I'd be crazy to not take that opportunity. Thanks to him is how we got Tristan, who's also in it, Tristan Risk. And I think I got to work with two really experienced people on my first thing. So I learned from that that's not something to be scared of. That's something you should try to do, because then you're surrounded by people who know more than you, and that you're just going to learn from them. And that's the idea. I'm trying to put the group, but he's such a talented person. Again, like you're saying, the horror people you think are going to be super weird. He's like the sweetest man in the world, who is also very weird, but I mean that as a total compliment.
Well, yeah, especially looking at his audition for Human Centipede 2 and what he did to that chair. He's a very, very weird man. But met him briefly at Fright Fest, but he seems absolutely lovely though. But yeah.
He has a background in performance art more so than acting, and you can totally see that. And almost like a look at Human Centipede 2 in a different light. Like, sure, it's this super gross out film, but it actually has like an insanely good performance at its center. Like, for it being this like super disgusting movie that plenty of people would never watch, like Lawrence carries that film and doesn't say a word in that entire movie. That's an incredible performance.
No, 100% agree. 100%
like, it's
agree.
A silent like role. It's insane. That's not easy.
And yeah, glad he was silent in that one. So you were also kind of looking at your kind of shorts and kind of what you've been up to. You're a second unit director for Jen and Sylvia Soska. That must have been a cool experience. Two of the kind of biggest name, especially female names in horror.
That was all connected to this freaking Call Girl experience, because Tristan Risk, who was in Call Girls, works with the Soskas. She was in American Mary. She played Beatrice, the character that was, you know, had plastic surgery to become look a lot like Betty Boop, the character. But through Tristan, it was this weird, crazy timing and just being in the right place at the right moment situation where the Soskas knew I was shooting Call Girl and that Lawrence was here in town with me, and they wanted just one little shot of Lawrence in their segment. So they asked me to shoot that for them. And then what's crazy is the ABCs of Death producers, they took that shot out of the twin segment and they put it at the very end of the whole movie, like it's now a secret shot at the end of the credits. And it's really just really fucked up, disturbing thing. It's not surprising at all if anyone remember, like, the Soska's segment was teased for torture porn and had Tristan Risk in it as well. She was playing a porn actor doing an audition for all these super creepy dudes, and all these spoiler alert, all these tentacles come out of her and start to do horrific things to the men. And what was going to happen, this is a cool story, was that it was going to cut out to suddenly Lawrence, like as if he was watching this on a web, like on his laptop, masturbating to it. And he's like, how the fuck am I supposed to wank to that? And so they take it and put that at the end of the whole movie. So it's kind of cool that now he's saying it about like the whole movie, but I had no idea they were doing it till I watched the movie. So I'm like watching the segment and then I was so upset. I'm like, oh, they took my shot out totally. And I had no idea. And then I was like beyond surprised when it was at the very end. I was like, holy crap. So it was fun. Very funny experience. We're shooting in my friend's apartment. Like, okay, this is what we're doing right now.
By the way, tentacle. There you go. No questions asked.
Lawrence is wearing wearing a shirt with a picture of himself on it from Human Centipede 2 in the shop, in the scene. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. I've managed to sneak Lawrence into a lot of other things. Like, I was assistant director on Frankenstein Created Bikers, James Bickert's film. Lawrence is in that. Lawrence also did the voice of a puppet in a film that I was the producer on called BFF Girls. It's a short film. So I'm always trying to bring Lawrence in somewhere. If anything, he's going to voice a puppet of a perverted cat. That's what he did in BFF Girls.
I swear, he's getting typecasted now.
Yeah, there's definitely a theme here. I'm sorry.
Cool. That is such a cool story. I love that. Go on. No, we need to do it. We need to segue into the second one because we can get carried away by talking about Lawrence all day. So yes, what is your second bloody good screen?
Great question. What is it? Let's talk about Lucky McKee's film May, which I've been called out for my clear inspiration on the stylist. For
never seen May. It's one of the ones of his I haven't seen, so
oh my gosh.
I know. Okay. It's always been on my list. It's always been
You're
on my list,
but I'm watch it immediately now that we've talked that I'm talking about it.
I will go straight into it.
what's interesting is I didn't see it also, like, I didn't see it when it first came out, which doesn't really make sense to me because I think it's like around 2005 or around like the time I'd be watching a lot of movies, and I didn't even hear about it. And years later, I remember seeing the image of her, which is like the poster image with it's her face and these like scissors around her. And then I knew a friend had her tattooed on him, and I'm like, what is this movie like? And then I finally watched it and just became obsessed with it. It's everything I love. It's a character piece about a woman who is kind of slowly losing grip with reality, which is clearly something I like if you've seen a stylist. And May, I think, is interesting because this is not spoilery, I don't think, but it's not like a serial killer. It's not like how Claire is clearly very insane from the start of the film. It's different. It's so much of a drama, like with these weird, tense thriller vibes. And then it's like a full blown horror movie when you get to the end. And it's just that the central performance by Angela Bettis is just like incredible. She is so sympathetic and so awkward and sweet. And it's just like heartbreaking to watch her kind of fall apart. And I laugh because I realize how morbid that sounds, but it's just such a good film and character piece. And I love it. I feel like everything else Lucky has done is so different from that. I love that film. I could go on forever. I don't know. There's so many little nods that we do to it in the film, like Claire's vanity in her basement where she sits down and like tries on her scalps that she's taken from people. May has a vanity she sits at, and it's just like there's little things. It's just a film that I love, and such a dear little character. You fall in love with her even though she's absolutely lost her mind by the end of it. A lot of people say that the film, the stylist, is like May Niack together, which I totally see that people think as those two films had a baby. But yeah.
I'm going to have to catch it because I'm obviously a huge fan of the stylist. And if it is kind of connected, I need to watch this now. I need to watch it. See the inspiration behind your film. So it's on the list. Definitely on the list. Okay. Let's go into why we're here, to talk about The Stylist. So how did it all kind of come about? Because it started as a short film. What was why did you pick this film to be kind of your one that you'd like to kind of turn into a full feature? Because it's your first feature movie. What was it about The Stylist that kind of really kind of pushed you to make it into a full film?
It was just something that from the beginning of the idea I wanted it to be a feature even before we made the short, but I knew and I wanted more experience. At that point I had only made Call Girl, and I just knew there's no way I was going to jump from the one short film to trying to make a feature. So, but I felt like that I already knew like The Stylist was going to be my first feature. It just like made sense to me as for the whole concept and like just everything about it. It's very personal. I am a hairstylist. I have been for a long time. And so it just made sense. Like, we'll start with a short film and then we'll write the feature and we'll have the short film to like use to hopefully help us make the feature. And major thing I learned in hindsight is I should have had the script ready for the feature, like totally ready, before the short came out to festivals, because that's when everyone asked us like, oh, is this a feature? Like, do you guys have a script? We want to see it. And we're like, it is a feature. We don't have the script yet. And by the time we did, we tried to get it financed for a couple years. And then finally I was just like, we got to make this now. Like, we're done waiting for someone to finance it. We got to figure out how we're going to finance it with like either Kickstarter or small amounts of money from private investors. And I just felt like it was just the concept that chose me. It wasn't like none of my other shorts to me feel like something I want to expand. They just exist to me as short stories. But this was always like, the short was just like a little peek into Claire's life. And then we were going to go show you more of it when we finally made the feature.
it's an interesting tale, your movie. I absolutely bloody love it. Is it? If you tell me this is based on true stories, I'll be absolutely happy about this. But but the inspiration behind it for the character, is it because you're a hairstylist yourself? Is this kind of something that you kind of thought about while cutting hair, that you'd like to tape people's hair?
Absolutely not. The idea of doing a movie about a hairstylist was really based upon the indie, low budget, just filmmaker thinking and teaching that they is in a lot of people's mind, and especially preached in Robert Rodriguez's book, Rebel Without a Crew. And just to a smart way to think as a starting out filmmaker without $1 million or really without $1 million. And so what do you have access to that's unique? What do you know that's unique? And access to is what I mean is locations or props or people or information or whatever it may be. I learned that early that filmmaking is, as far as making it look better, production value is all about having really cool locations, because you don't have the money to build a set from scratch or design a room from scratch. So with that kind of thinking, I was just salons, I'm in salons all the time, work in a salon. I've never seen a movie largely set in a salon. I've never seen a movie about a hairstylist as the protagonist of any genre. And so I just thought I have access to these locations that are unique and cool, and I know about this world, and I can do it as true to reality as possible within our constraints. Because you see so many professions represented in movies that don't look like they're represented in a real way at all. I know you can't completely do stuff the real way, because you're not having, say, an actual hairstylist play the stylist, so I can't show her actually cutting hair without maybe, but we actually used stunt hands in close-ups. Okay. But that's a totally different story. But it just came from this thing of this is something that I know that I can put a extremely personal touch on that will come that will resonate. And of course there's tons of little things in Claire that are me, or just in her taste of I love her fashion even though I don't dress that way. I love it. Or her dog is mine, or the scene of her eating soup is you can't even see what she's eating, but I wrote it to be something I would do. And so there's a lot of her in me and her, but I don't write stuff out of vengeance. I definitely don't have violent tendencies I'm trying to act out in my films. I think that is something we laugh about, but if someone's doing that, you might, maybe we need to talk to a therapist about this. I have, to be honest, I have exercised vengeance in dialogue. I have in things that have happened to me, I've put into scenes, but I haven't but whenever any violence that is in my movie isn't done out of fantasy for being interested. It's just to me it's fun, and but it's I get that question all the time, of course, because I'm a hairstylist and I do love to tell people while I'm doing their hair, they're that don't know already what I'm doing, I'm I made a movie about a hairstylist that kills people, and they're oh shit, what am I doing? So I do like to scare people in that way, but I swear no. But really, yeah, it just became from, I think what makes films ultimately stick with people is it being personal in some way. Too many horror filmmakers are too concerned with just trying to make something that's the most something you've never seen before, or that is super nasty, or the most shocking. Mm-hmm. And it's I don't know. It's interesting. I thought that since I've done this and had these questions so many times, I wonder if this world hasn't been represented in movies very much because throughout history, most films have been made by men. Most salons are full of women, and that's probably why you haven't seen it yet.
Quite possibly. Quite possibly. I mean,
Except for Sweeney Todd, who was a man.
But then he was also making pies, but yeah, no.
Yeah. Claire and Sweeney Todd will get together and make some pie.
We kind of see why Claire's doing it, though. It's a strange situation because she's a very sympathetic character. You kind of feel quite bad for her because from the viewer's point, she's only really doing this as a coping mechanism. That's how I read it. I'm probably wrong, but you know, she wants to quit it. She does quit it, and then it's the Hindu which kind of sets it back off, and she's doing it to make herself feel better. So she, tell me if I'm wrong. I'm kind of seeing it as she's kind of taking the hair and putting the hair on herself, so she isn't herself, so she can be somebody different because she feels so bad about herself.
Yeah, yeah. To me, it was always the idea that she wanted to escape her own mind and just feel what it feels like to be someone else for a moment. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really just about that, not so much about perfection, which I realized the short film made people kind of focus on that, which naturally that's a theme because of the beauty industry and everyone striving for this impossible idea of perfection at all times. But yeah. Claire has become so simple. It's been interesting to hear so many people's different takes on her, which I'm really excited that's been possible. Because to me, she's someone dealing with like identity issues, and it can be interpreted in so many different ways. And we left it open intentionally so that people could, you know, insert their own reasoning and whatever for it.
Because to me, watching it, it's if you have depression or kind of you suffer from that and you kind of want to be someone else, and seeing her kind of wanting to be the people she's gotten the hair of because they have these exciting lives, and she feels like her life isn't kind of as exciting, but especially the first lady that she kind of takes the hair off of. You know, she goes back to her a couple of times and she goes through a different hairstyle, but nothing suits her right. One question I do want to ask. The final scenes where, I don't know, spoilers, is it that Claire wanted to be with the bride, or was it that she wanted to be the bride? Because there's a lot of the backstory which kind of goes back to a wedding, which I'm assuming is the wedding she should have had, but
she wants to be her, kind of like just how I was saying, she wants to feel what it's like to be someone else. And so the ending is like this grand, my attempt at this Shakespearean type of way over the top dramatic ending, where this kind of like coming out moment for her, like, she's finally going to get to be someone else in front of everyone else. Like, she gets to come out and expose herself for what she really wants to be and be seen finally. But I think she also knows somewhere like that this is like a fleeting moment. This can't go on past this one moment. So it's kind of this like suicide in a way, like she knows it can't go
like an end game kind of
past thing. Here. Once she's exposed this, it's over. But like she could, it's almost like this is her only way to stop herself from continuing to do it in this very dark, messed up way. Like a self sabotage. Like I kind of see the whole. Yeah. End of the there's like leading up to the ending scenes, the night before, she's really spiraling, and each scene she's it's kind of getting more insane, and that she's just completely kind of completely losing touch of the version of Claire who could kind of like she had everything kind of compartmentalized and nice and organized. Like the killer version of herself was over here, the person she could present in public is over here, and then all that, just she loses like all control of that, and
she starts making mistakes, and it kind of spirals.
But it wasn't really like that. There's a previous wedding that was just that, you know, with it's interesting. The wedding thing really just came to me because that's something hairstylists are always involved in. And that's like when the ending came to me in the writing process, I was so excited. I was like, I was so confident in it. I knew, I'm like, this is the ending. It's good. That's so, it was like everything I wanted, this like big theatrical over the top tragic moment that we could like design set wise really cool. And so it is I just come to terms with myself about what I was doing kind of narratively, because I was like, I wanted her Claire to be so grounded emotionally and relatable, but kind of the stuff we're doing is very theatrical, and I was like, how do we ride this line? And I feel like it's all in Najara's performance. She makes it work somehow and doesn't make it feel
amazing in this, actually.
Yeah, she is a dream, and we would never have made this movie if she wasn't going to come back and be Claire. And I mean, all of us, to like even my DP, the production designer, all the producers, we were like, she's going to lead us into this. We don't, like, there's no way we would do this without her. She like brought her to life in the most perfect way in the short film. And she'd been just as invested in the project as we were writing it, and really helped build that character.
Again, absolutely love the film. So if you haven't seen the film yet, I'm not going to ask too many questions because I don't want to kind of throw any major spoilers out there. But go and see the film now. I beg of you. It is my number one film of the year. It still is after all the films I've seen this year. Go and see it. You will not be disappointed. So let's segue to the final bloody good screen. What is your last film pick?
Oh, man. One of the best movies in the world. Like the most, maybe like a perfectly made film. Seven by David Fincher. To, you know, just kind of amazing barely film. Barely veer off straight horror. Which we all have these debates on Twitter, and I don't even fucking want to start about thriller versus horror. But I will say, I do understand that there's a difference. Oftentimes, movies are both things. There's nothing wrong with them being both at the same time. And there's nothing wrong with understanding the difference in the definition of, you know, it's just like, it's just kind of, to me, perspective. Like, you could tell a more horror version of Seven, but that would be like if you were following along with the victims versus following along with the detectives, which makes it a crime thriller. And, but it, like, of course, it's, yeah, still a fucking horror movie. We still see all this gore, and it's, but it's definitely, I kind of think that's the difference. It's, I don't, it all combines. I love thriller, I love crime, and I love horror. So that's like all three of those. And
it's a very fine line. It's such a fine line between crime and horror. So now, I spoke to an author, Mark Billingham, on the book podcast about a month or so ago, and he writes a series of crime novels in the UK. And he said, while it is a crime thriller, he never kind of marketed it as a crime thriller. A lot of his first three books is more horror, and even though it is set in a crime kind of setting, the horrific acts are more kind of based in horror than it is kind of in the kind of crime side. Obviously, the more he went on and the more his publisher pushed for it to be more of a thriller, then he got more kind of into the cop kind of detective side of it. But it's such a thin line. And this is why the argument of is Silence of the Lambs a horror film kind of gets thrown in there as well. But I see kind of Seven more like Saw. I mean, Saw technically, yes, it's a horror film, but it's also technically a crime or a thriller. Yeah. It is. Yeah.
It's interesting because I feel like it's almost like the difference is, like, what is the film's intention? Like, what feeling are they intending us to feel? Because to me, like, something like Seven isn't necessarily scary because it's more methodical. We're more, like, along the story. We're experiencing everything, even though there are a couple maybe kind of tense, scary moments. But it's not designed to scare us. But then what's weird is I would say, like, the stylist, I didn't design to scare people. To me, it's like I'm taking you along with Claire. She's the bad guy, but you're on her side. But it's, of course, still like a horror movie because she's killing people. But to me, I always was always approaching it like a psychological thriller drama that has horror, like horror scenes, like slasher scenes. And but so I really think it's just such a weird thing to describe. It's like, I could almost totally defend that, like, Seven isn't a horror movie. And then I could totally defend that it is. I could do the same thing with Silence of the Lambs. Because to me, like, it's totally obviously crime until, like, those scenes between Clarice and Hannibal are, like, super tense and scary. Even just those conversations. Or when she's walking through the, you know, Buffalo Bill's house in the dark. But it's like, but I can totally see someone saying that they're not horror movies. And I understand what they mean. It's just like, like, people have to get in such a freaking roar about it. I understand because we love horror so much that we don't like it when people, like, take these movies, like, don't want to call, like, a really prestigious film a horror movie. I think that's part of it. But, yeah, Seven. I could talk about it forever. I'm a huge David Fincher fan, like, in general. I mean, he's, like, the king of the freaking crime thriller that what we're talking about right now, like Zodiac and Seven might be my favorite too. And I love the show that he's a, you know, Mindhunter that he's part of on Netflix. I love
Mindhunter.
Produces. And I mean, it's like Zodiac turned into a show. So it's like a dream scenario. And it's interesting. He's a filmmaker that I love that doesn't make stuff that feels super personal to him, which is, it's a weird thing for me to realize because I like stuff that feels personal. His stuff doesn't in that way. But Seven, you know, for being such a methodical crime movie, it's also like super emotional. You're as in Brad Pitt's like mind at the end of that movie. Talk about a motherfucking ending. Like, is there any, like, the best endings in all of all time? Like, that's like one of the best. You can't compete with Seven. Like, there's nothing, I wouldn't even call it a twist, but there's nothing that's gonna, like, that, like, talk about it, the most shocking moment of all, like, the most gut punch of a moment where you can feel that so deeply, like, and you're just pleading, like, don't do it, Brad, don't do it. But, like, you would, like, anyone would do it. It's like one of the most emotional, intense, freaking badass endings of any story, like, movie ever. It's so cool.
You just don't open the box. Just don't open the box. You don't want to do it. And Morgan Freeman's amazing as anyway in everything he's in anyway. So, you know.
Someone told me that there was a cut of the, I don't know, I didn't believe them because I'm upset that I haven't seen it if it's true, but that there's a cut of the film where you do see into the box for like a second. I've never seen such a thing. I have heard that they considered doing it and they realized like it was unnecessary, that like this moment is maybe even more powerful not seeing it, not like giving into like just shock value, like instead staying on Brad Pitt. Like, I think that was like an emotionally smart choice as if the direct, like, instead of like, let's focus on how nasty it is, instead we're going to stay with like the emotion of the moment and like such a freaking
incredible. But in a way, it's still nasty just by seeing his reaction.
Yeah, it's like,
sometimes you don't need that big reveal. You just see his face. So, and you know what's going to be in the box.
Oh my God. Just thinking about it now, I'm just like, what an accomplishment. Oh, did you? Someone gave me the script of Seven. I'm so excited to read it. I've never read it. But they recently announced that the writer of Seven and David Fincher are team, like, they're collaborating again on a film that I think is for Netflix. So that is very exciting. I learned that the writer of Seven also wrote, what the hell is it called? Do I seriously have it right here on my thing? That, what is that, whatever millimeter with Nicolas Cage?
8mm.
Yes, that's the same writer. And it's kind of amazing to think of, what if like Fincher could have made that 8mm. Anyway, but yeah.
I think Mindhunter, though, is amazing television. It's such a shame that I haven't got a new series. Series 3, because you're getting so close to the BTK reveal. And it's just right on the edge of it. It's really
right here in my part of the country. I grew up in Kansas, which is where BTK is from. I don't know what I heard last about the show, if the third season is being filmed, or he said something about how he's interested in doing it, Fincher, or what the hell. That's the one thing that, like,
he wants to do. I think Netflix, I think, just seems to be dragging their heels a little bit.
I'm like, I'm nowhere near that kind of status yet, but I'm like begging my agent and like drop little things like, that would be my dream. Can you get me a job of directing an episode of Mindhunter for David Fincher, please? Because Fincher normally just directs the first and the last episode, or the first two and last two. But it's like,
then just kind of showruns the rest of it.
I'd love to do episodic stuff, and that would be the ultimate pinnacle dream. Working on something like Mindhunter.
That is a brilliant choice. Seven is one of those ones growing up, which I remember very fondly.
I actually have a very fucked up story about the first time I saw it. My friend's mom, like, we're only like 12, and she's going to let us watch it, which is fucked up. But she tells us she's going to not let us watch one scene. So at the time, I didn't know what scene that was. It was the lust scene, the whole lust situation. Which is just like so telling, especially of like American sexual repression versus how we look at violence. Because it's like, at our age, the whole movie is fucking disturbing. We shouldn't have watched any of it. But the only part they're concerned about us watching was the part that has anything to do with sex and violence together. Which, of course, that scene is, or that whole kill and like see thing is absolutely horrific, and I definitely shouldn't have seen it at 12, but it's like, but the whole movie's fucked up. Maybe we just shouldn't have been able to watch any of it, let alone just editing the one scene out, which of course made us like watch it right away when she like left the room. It's like, now you just made us like can't wait to see what the hell you've hidden from us, you know?
Yeah. Brilliant choice. Perfect choice for this podcast. So I've got a couple of questions from a couple of people over on Facebook. It's very short notice, so there's not many questions. But would you mind answering a couple of questions?
Not at all.
Cool. So Andrew of Horror Oasis, great website, go check it out. He's asked, who are some other women in horror who influence your work? Is there anybody, any female directors or producers, writers that kind of influence you as well?
Yes, I'm like, where to begin with this list? I could go on with obviously the Soskas that we already talked about, and kind of in more recent, like, I feel like I've discovered so many female filmmakers in recent years. Like, I loved Coralie she's a French filmmaker, I can't say her name right, I'm sure, Farget, or who made Revenge. That film floored me. I felt the decisions she made in that film were so, so provocative and so brave, and had so much to say about a very tough subject that's been done a lot, but not by women. And loved that film. Also loved, now I'm on a French kick, I can't say anyone's names, but the woman who made Raw. I love that film.
See, I'm not the only one who can't do surnames.
All of our names are hard to say, damn it. Well, I think we figured cool, unique last names are, I like them. Like, if you become famous enough, everyone will figure it out. Like Martin Scorsese, everyone figured out how to say his name finally. but other women, like Gigi Salguero comes to mind, who I've kind of got to work with through working on stuff with the Soskas. There's just so many. I finally got to see, what the heck was it? Which I feel like it took forever to finally get access to. Saint Maud. I finally got to see. I feel like I've been waiting, like anticipating it for 2 years, and I loved it, which is also a feat, because when you anticipate something for that long, it's like you're putting way too much pressure on the film. but yeah, so many things have come out in recent years. I'm also a huge fan of like Kathryn Bigelow, who I feel like is like the queen of women filmmakers, and like really inspired by her journey and how not like stereotypically feminine it is, which I think a lot of people expect like romance or whatever from women, but they don't expect like a woman who like started in horror and then moved on to like action and then moved on to like war films. Like, she's a fucking badass. And I think her whole like filmmaking journey is incredibly inspiring. Oh, Sofia Coppola. Like, I'm obsessed with Virgin Diaries or Virgin Suicides. What the fuck is Virgin Diaries? A totally different thing. And Lost in Translation is one of my favorite films. Awesome. Yeah, so many women I could talk about. Sorry, I'm not good at answering questions quickly. I'll work on
it. That's fine. That's fine. There's no rush. a lot of people have asked as well what kind of movies have inspired you, which we've kind of covered throughout the podcast. But is there anything else, any other movies that kind of inspired you to kind of want to kind of in your films or that you wanted to make, yeah, that you wanted to make you do it? We have discussed this already, but is there any kind of other films you could throw out there?
One big one would be Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, the one with Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio. That film came out when I was like 12. Classic. And really had a freaking crazy strong impression on me, and I just became psychotically obsessed with it, is the best way to describe it. And I still love it, and it's like influenced everything I make and do, and I love it. Yes.
It's a brilliant film. It's a brilliant film. It's a question I'm gonna ask anyway, because is how I normally end it, but I'll throw this out to my kind of last question. Terry Sherwood has asked, said, you probably will already ask this anyway, yeah, but what is your next project you're working on? He unfortunately missed out on your to fund your Kickstarter, so he would love to know what you're working on next, as he really, really loved the Star List.
Well, thank you. I wish I could talk about something in detail, but I'm just working on a couple of things. Like, I'm working on some things with other writers that I'm would be the director on once we start to make it. I'm working with the writers of the Fangoria film Porno that came out a couple of years ago on something new. And, really, I can't talk. There's nothing exciting to talk about, unfortunately. Because I don't like to talk about projects until I'm making them. That, so,
yeah. It's much easier to ask authors, you see, because authors are normally writing stuff and they like to tell you what it is. But I know a lot of the film stuff, especially, because I've spoken to a few authors who have kind of film work, and they're like, I'll talk to you when it comes out. We'll discuss it then. We'll come back and we'll talk about it then. So,
yeah.
Two different, completely different worlds. Thank you so much for coming on. I absolutely loved this conversation with you. Where can people find your social media if you'd like to be found?
Yes, thank you for having me on. And I would love to be found. As creepy as that sounds, I realize as I'm saying it. You can find me on like all the social medias at Jill Six with two X's, or my website sixtape.com, which reminds me I need to work on, I need to update so many things on there. And at the Stylist Film on all the social medias to keep up with all the new stuff coming, because we are streaming on Arrow right now, but June 7th and 8th, we're going to come out on VOD and Blu-ray, so we'll be accessible in more places really soon.
Awesome. Again, thank you to Jill for coming on to podcast today. But I'm over on Twitter at Bloody Good Reads, Instagram at Bloody Good Reads, and yeah, we've got some amazing guests coming up in on the podcast coming up as well, so do come and check out the monthly episodes. Might do two episodes. And as always, you can catch me over on Bloody Good Reads, over on Instagram, Bloody Good Reads as well. And we've got some brilliant people from the horror genre coming up on this podcast as well. And yeah, as always, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll see you next time.